Good morning. It's great to see those of you who are here interested in this topic. My name is Derek. I'm a professor of interactive media at Elon University. But I'm kind of here just representing a larger collective. Today I'm a mouthpiece for a group of us who have been thinking about this and working on this for a while. I've got some colleagues who are hopefully going to be monitoring us remotely from various places. Gudjonmar Gudjonsson is in Reykjavik, and Thorgils Valundarsson is in Reykjavik, and Gunnar Holmstein, I think, is in San Francisco right now, but he's splitting his time from in a couple different places. Who are you? Are you developers? Designers? Activists? Other creators? All of the above? Okay. In some ways, I think this is a little bit typical of these non-traditional types of South by panels. You have a title, something like Envisioning a Better World, and you don't get, you know, this monolithic audience of, you know, people interested in the newest CSS or HTML techniques. So that's kind of interesting. And what I wanted to start with was maybe to give you the chance to think about what caught your attention, what got you interested in this idea of a better world in conjunction with a professional industry conference. So my question is, what values guide your work in creating a better world? What I'd like you to do in the next 60 seconds, because we are in this small, intimate little group here, is I'd like you to introduce yourself to someone and talk a little bit about this idea of values, because I think values are important and maybe we don't address them often in this industry. So I'm serious. Go ahead. 60 seconds. So your time is essentially up. And I guess my question is, some of you, what are some of the values that came out of your conversations? This very brief chance interacting with probably a stranger. What values came out of these conversations? Yeah.
Openness.
What else? What was that?
Creativity.
Yes, excellent.
Action. Got to do something.
Excellent, excellent. So this is something that... again, we don't... Values are really important to us. Our individual values and our community values are something that's probably key to our practice. But it's probably not something that we spend a lot of time talking with strangers about, right? It guides us more silently. We don't spend... we just don't have this interaction. So what do you value? And what's driving you to try to make the world better? So I think this is kind of useful. And this was a discussion that I wanted to begin with because it leads me to my first premise. My first premise is that any given audience at a conference like this, at a diverse conference like this, is probably going to have a lot of people in the audience, a diverse audience, innovative people, who are interested in more than just receiving information, right? I think the amount of back channel discussion, the amount of side conversations that you see in any of the keynotes, it speaks to that a little bit, is that we have... lots of the time, we have an audience that's probably more creative and better informed and smarter than the person up on the stage. So this method, this orientation is a little bit antiquated, I think. And so part of what I want to do is put that in your mind. And next, this is the premise of this overall session, is that next year at South By, we're going to try something pretty different. We're going to try a big, interesting, unusual session that looks at the role of interactive technologies in creating a better world. And this panel, this session today, is my call to ask you to participate in this. For the next 40 minutes or so, I'm not going to take up all this time because, like I said, I really want this to be conversational. I'm going to talk about a couple of different things. So this project emerges from a very special and somewhat peculiar context, Iceland. Are there any Icelanders here? Okay, so I don't have to apologize in advance for oversimplifications and outright lies that I might say about the country. Except for everyone on Twitter and the people that will be listening to this later. Right. So second, I'm going to talk about one particular project that came out of Iceland that I think is pretty interesting. And finally, talking about how all this ultimately informs what we're working on for South by next year. Okay? If you're not from Iceland, you probably don't know that much about Iceland. Iceland is a volcanic island in the North Atlantic. It's about the size of Kentucky. The entire population of this nation is about 300,000. So it's about, the entire population of the country is about like a St. Louis or a Corpus Christi or a Pittsburgh. The capital is Reykjavik, which is about 120,000 people. And it seems much bigger than that. It's a nice little city. And it's about a 5-hour, more or less, flight from New York or Washington. It's pretty easy to get there. So definitely encourage you to vacation there or check it out sometime. The history of Iceland informs this in some interesting ways. So this is why I want to go back not just a few years, but I want to go back 1,000 years. Iceland was settled by Vikings and their Celtic slaves really a long time ago. And the reason that these Vikings took their slaves to Iceland was because they were trying to get away from the increasing centralization of power that was taking place in Norway, primarily. So they were from the very beginning, a very independent-minded people. And they were very distrustful of big government, as we might say today. So these Vikings came out to Iceland. They found a beautiful land that was largely uninhabited. There were a few Irish monks there, but they left as soon as the Vikings showed up. And eventually, in about 930 AD, they established a parliament. And this was one of the first Western parliaments. And if you talk to Icelanders, they say this is one of the oldest continuously functioning parliaments, if you kind of think about government in interesting ways. But this is a very, very old democratic tradition there. And so for about 300 years after the founding of this parliament, you have a very independent and a remarkably democratic type of country out there in the middle of nowhere. But unfortunately, Iceland wasn't able to defend its independence for very long, because as they were being very independent out in Iceland, in Norway and the rest of Scandinavia, life was going on. The kings were getting bigger. They were building bigger armies. And eventually Iceland was passed over to Norway, and then it went to Denmark. And it kind of got pitched back and forth between Norway and Denmark for the next 700 years or so. And this 1700 years was a pretty rough time. There was quite a bit of starvation and plague, and some volcanoes went off. So this was not a good time. And Iceland was the poorest and most isolated little corner of Europe. Icelanders started more seriously agitating for independence in the 19th century. And this eventually culminated in their independence. So in the 1940s, after Hitler invaded Denmark, which happened to have Iceland at this time, Icelanders declared independence. And since the Danes were occupied with Nazis and, honestly, they probably didn't care that much, Iceland became an independent country. Formally in 1944, to create a new constitution for this new country in 1944. They basically took the Danish constitution and they scratched out the word king, where the word king appeared, and they wrote in the word president. And that was the governing document of this new republic for the next 50, 60 years. After the war, And after independence, things got really good really fast. So in a kind of controversial move, Iceland joined NATO, and the U.S. built a military base there to keep the dirty commies out. And this brought in a huge amount of capital. It brought in a huge amount of commerce. And so Iceland went from being this very rural, poor and backwards type of country to a very highly developed country. And so by the 1990s, Iceland was had one of the highest standards of living in the world. In the early 2000s, the Icelandic bankers and government, in their wisdom, greatly deregulated the financial industry. And for the next several years, things got really, really good. Iceland got really, really rich. The standard of living continued to go through the roof. And Iceland was at the top of every list that a country wants to be at the top of. Right, so this was the wealthiest per capita country, it was the happiest per capita country, it was the healthiest per capita country. Things were going really well. And what was interesting that when I started first thinking about Iceland, or it came to my attention, was that everybody looked at Iceland, regardless of your political orientation, regardless of where you're coming from, and saw Iceland as something of a model. You know, if you were a left-winger, you saw this Nordic welfare state, you know, with high taxes and lots of services provided and free healthcare and free education, and you're like, that's fantastic. And if you were a right-winger, you looked at it and you saw, this is free market capitalism. You know, they got rid of all these pesky regulations and they're doing things right, and look at how rich everybody is getting. Look at how this nation is progressing. You know, 50 years ago, they were living in turf huts, and now they're the most developed country in the world. But as you may have heard, or as you might know, this wouldn't necessarily last. In the fall of 2008, there were these shockwaves going through the world economy. You know, these collapses of businesses, and people were realizing that something has got to give. Something is not going to work. In Iceland, three banks collapsed within a very short period of time, which had these huge ripple effects throughout the Icelandic economy. And so it led to kind of three distinct crises, really important crises. So first of all was the fact that the economy, you know, the financial system was in chaos. The second thing that happened was that the value of the Icelandic krona. So Iceland, you go to Iceland and you spend krona just like we spend dollars. The krona is the smallest independent currency in the world. And what happened to the krona when all this happened was that the value of it plummeted. And normally this would, you know, this is kind of what's supposed to happen. You know, currencies are supposed to fluctuate against one another. And this is supposed to ease recovery because, you know, when your currency is cheap, then you have more money coming into your country. But the reason this was so bad for the Icelanders was that lots of everyday Icelanders had taken out loans, you know, for cars and for houses and things. But they didn't take out loans in kroner. They took out loans in euros and pounds. So when the currency collapsed, you saw people's loans go two or three times higher, basically overnight. So imagine you've been paying on your mortgage for, you know, 5 or 6 years, and all of a sudden you have to pay three times as much. And your payments go up three times what they were previously. And of course the tax base collapsed. And so all of these really, really bad things happened that we don't imagine happening in a highly developed country. And so this was a crisis that the developed world had really never seen before. The economy of Iceland collapsed. And Icelanders were pretty angry about this, as you might imagine. This is the Prime Minister of Iceland, Geir Horda. And on October 6th, 2008, he went on TV to give this national address. And basically said, well, things are pretty rough. We tried everything we could. Go spend time with your family. God bless Iceland. Now, can you imagine President Bush or President Obama giving a speech like that and what effect that would have? You know, basically, we can't do anything else. Suck it up and God bless us, because that's the only blessing we're going to get now. And so people were really, really scared, really upset, And they responded to this in some maybe obvious ways. One response was massive protests. And of course, this is still Iceland, so massive means thousands of people, you know, not tens of thousands or anything, or millions. But there were massive protests in front of the government. And these protests were not particularly violent. They threw custard and milk at the parliamentarians and banged on pots and pans. And this looks like they're burning cars, but it's probably just a bonfire or something. So they protested the government. And the government changed eventually. There was a new parties were elected into power. But what they realized is that the new parties really didn't have any tools that the old parties didn't have. And so this attempt at, you know, demanding change by marching in the streets could only be so effective, because ultimately this doesn't get at kind of the root causes of the problem. And keep in mind that this is a context where there's no trust in the system at all. So the government was implicated in the scandal. So Mr. Horta is actually the first governmental official to be facing trial related to negligence in the financial crisis right now. The business, you know, business, everyone, everything was linked. Everyone was involved. So all of these existing institutions had nothing to offer the people. You know, why should we place our trust in these things again after they betrayed us so badly? So a second approach kind of emerged, and this is where I became particularly interested in what is going on. People were coming up with, there's a grassroots that emerged. You know, and part of this grassroots came from the newly unemployed, but part of this grassroots came from people who had been kind of talking about these things and thinking about these things for a long time. And a lot of these activists happened to be designers and developers and hackers and people more or less like us. And with this type of community, looking at these types of problems, you start to see certain types of solutions emerge. And so one thing that happened was you saw lots of projects starting up. Some of them were kind of crazy. Some of them were pretty innovative. But the idea was that you could start something fast and see if it worked, see if it made something better. If it didn't, toss it by the wayside, start something else. If it did, continue on with it, advance it, refine it, keep playing around with it. So there was something of a what have we got to lose attitude here, which made things really interesting. But there was also a forced introspection that the Icelanders had. They're like, okay, we're not going to be a financial powerhouse in the world anymore. We can't go back to turf huts and starvation. So really, who are we? What do we want to do? Who do we want to be? And so I think this is a big part of why you see these really kind of out there projects, you know, testing the limits of institutions, testing the limits of technology and democracy. And so to put this, I guess, in terms that might be closer to us, they were rapidly prototyping democracy and democratic institutions. So even though you have this crisis in Iceland, and things are really bad, Iceland still has some pretty powerful resources. So they have a still affluent population, a very educated population. They have one of the highest connectivity rates in the world. So I think per capita, they have the highest rates of Facebook penetration, for example. You know, everyone's online. So that's kind of an interesting context. You also have abundant natural resources. And you have the fact that you're stuck on an island. You know, there was some, you know, immigration, people trying to get away, but basically you're stuck there. So you have to fix things if you want to live there. So this is my very brief primer on Iceland and this context. The context is specific, the context is very unique. There's no other place in the world that's exactly like Iceland. But all over the world, we see societies that are grappling with economic pressures. We see societies that are grappling with democratic malaise. We see societies that are grappling with social dissatisfaction with their institutions. So these things are not unique. And that's why I think that it behooves us to pay some attention to what's going on here. Because if they find out they're trying crazy things, and they're getting good results, then let's take what we can learn from that. One of these organizations that emerged in the midst of the crisis was something called the Ministry of Ideas. And this is was a group that was kind of ad hoc called together by a Icelandic entrepreneur, a tech entrepreneur named Gudjon Mark Gudjonsson. And his idea was to let's start bringing people together to talk about innovation and to talk about new models for fixing things. So they started having weekly meetings. And they started with 20 people, and then they had 80 people, and then they had hundreds of people showing up at these meetings. And the initial focus was really on starting new businesses. But ultimately, it kind of morphed into this idea that, well, let's take our expertise and our know-how and try to filter that into our society. So let's innovate not just businesses, but let's innovate Iceland itself. So the Ministry of Ideas was kind of a fertile ground for lots of these interesting projects. And if I had more time, I'd tell you about them. But the one that I want to talk about is something called the National Assembly, or the series of National Assemblies. And in this case, the Ministry of Ideas, which was kind of a loose organization, got together with other loose organizations who were interested in these ideas, and they wanted to build something. They wanted to build a new institution that could produce a new vision for Iceland, and produce a vision that would be well-regarded. So again, anything coming from the top would be tossed out as irrelevant. So they needed to build a new institution that would have some authority, would have, give some people some hope, basically. This is a very, pretty grim time for a lot of people. So they call themselves the Anthill. This is a collective, and they call themselves ants. And the idea had something to do with ants can recognize danger when they see it and move their society away from the danger. And every ant is important to the whole and equal. Maybe it doesn't translate as well in English, but that's the idea. And there are two pieces to this National Assembly project, this new institution project that they did. So the first part, the first piece of this thing, was developing a methodology for kind of brainstorming or kind of focus grouping or kind of crowdsourcing to develop a new institution that would allow lots of people to come together and build something very democratically. So again, how do you get the grassroots to come up and build something? So they built this process that now they kind of they call it the Agora visioning process or the Agora method that emphasized these key values that they said were very important. So it was designed to promote things like independent viewpoints and creative thinking. It was designed not to promote conflict or debate about issues, but it was designed to allow lots of people to come together to generate a shared vision, to collaborate on a vision. The other piece of this, so that's the first piece of this methodology. I'll post these slides online, by the way. I'll put this slide deck online. The other piece of this puzzle was to go big, really big. This is a time-lapse video of the setup for the first National Assembly. This is in a sports hall. So the first National Assembly in 2009 brought together 1,500 participants. There were 300 change makers or visionaries who were specifically invited. And these were politicians and people from industries and teachers and journalists. But the remaining 1,200 people that were invited to this session were chosen, they were sampled from the entire population from the National Registry. So they came from all across Iceland. They represented all demographics. The youngest participants were 18. The oldest were 100. And the idea was that you get all of these people together, and these were everyday people, and get them talking about a vision for the future, get them talking about where they wanted to see their country go. This number was kind of important too, this 1500 number, because it was 0.5% of the population of Iceland, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a pretty big sample for a population that size. You know, in the US, the equivalent sample would be about 1.6 million people. So this was a significant thing, and the idea was that what came out of this would have some of that authority that would be lacking in a top-down type of event. So you could kind of see how the structure worked, and it was 8 participants to a table and 1 facilitator at each table. So the participants were actually there talking with one another and brainstorming and going through this process. The facilitator was neutral, something like a focus group moderator maybe, making sure that this somewhat involved process was going smoothly and enforcing a kind of rigorous democracy at the table. You know, ensuring that each person there was contributing and ensuring that each person there was really participating in the process in a good way. The basic structure of this was that it's a series of brainstorming rounds. You know, these rounds lasted from 20 minutes to about an hour, and the data from each round was aggregated and sent back to a back room for processing and then fed back into the population. So people could see what everyone else was doing in this huge room, right? There was kind of this good buzz, this good vibe going on, but they could also see what was happening everywhere, what the different topics that were emerging were, what the different ideas that were emerging were. And so it was a mixture of high-tech and low-tech tools, right? They used paper and pen and dots to vote on things and sort things and collaborate on ideas. And then this was all fed back to them on, there were big screens around the room. They were able to summarize and show people what were going on. And it was designed so that the themes that emerged in the early sessions were then used to set the agenda for the later sessions. So from the very beginning, this was a democratic process. So there wasn't an agenda that was out. Only the structure was in place. And what the participants decided to talk about was what ultimately made it all the way through this the system. The linchpin for this process were these trained facilitators. And in a little bit I'll talk more about the actual process. But these facilitators were at each table, and the attendees, the participants didn't prepare. Right? They just showed up. They didn't have to read anything. They didn't represent anyone. They were just there to be themselves, to participate in this. So the really important thing were these facilitators who went through, who spent a lot of time learning the methodology and training on it to make sure that this huge event with a really huge number of moving pieces went well. So this was the output of the 2009 session. So the first thing was a summary report. That basically took all of these ideas and summarized it in an interesting way. So this was kind of what most people looked at. This is what the media were reporting on. This is what the government was taking note of, was this report about what is important. And the kind of the things that came up, things like integrity and honesty and protecting the environment and ensuring social welfare. You know, these were the ideas that Icelanders thought were important. And the within each idea, there were specific pieces about it. There's also a really interesting thing that happened was the assembly also produced structured data sets. So these data sets contained relational data that connected each individual participant and their demographics back to the ideas that they had and the things that they believed in and the things that they supported. And so this data set was released, it was open source. All of this stuff is open source. All of the stuff was made completely transparent and open. And there were some interesting things that came out of it. For example, there's a company called Clara that was working with this data, and they looked at how well Parliament and parliamentarians mapped to this vision of the Icelanders. So this chart, for example, represents each political party is a color, and if the party was in agreement, that error bar is high. If the party was not in agreement, that error bar is low. So we see that, you know, clear at the end, on the green, we have a party that was relatively narrow. Most of the people, members of parliament in that party were in agreement with the vision. You know, at the end, other end, we have something that's a little more uniformly low. And of course, the second one shows that this is the Greens, I think. You know, they really ranged from being very much in agreement to very, very little in agreement. And here's just another interesting, this is the same data, but visualized for individual members of parliament. So this, the two axes, let's see. I don't actually read Icelandic, but what's happening here is, I think the vertical axis represents the amount of speeches, the amount of talking that a member of parliament did over a given period of time. And then the horizontal axis represents the amount of agreement with the vision. So what was the correlation between what parliamentarians said and this vision that the people themselves had actually articulated? And so you can see, you know, individual parliamentarians by party represented all over here. So this was the 2009 National Assembly. It was, there were skeptics about this. You know, the idea that this was just kind of an empty exercise, it was just producing rhetoric. But it turned out to, I would argue, be very, very well received. And maybe the best indication of how this worked and the good reception that this got was that the parliament itself looked to this project and said, let's do this again. But let's do this as the first phase of writing our new constitution. We would take rewriting a constitution in the U.S. as being something pretty... We wouldn't do it, right? In other states, it happens more often. So the parliament passed an act saying, we're going to do one more of these national assemblies, but we're going to ask people to talk about what values they want to see enshrined in the constitution. And then this data was provided to the committee that wrote the constitution. And so we see a direct, democratic, transparent transference of the values of the people into the code of the country, into the constitution of the country. And this constitution is actually is also another thing that I could talk a lot about because it was so fascinating, because, you know, it was open to Facebook comments and everybody was chatting about it, and, you know, it was basically kind of constitution not exactly by Wiki and not exactly by Facebook, but there were elements of this there. And a lot of a lot of outsiders said this is crazy. But the outcome was pretty good. The results were pretty good. So the conclusion of the second part of my talk is this, that these epic, radically transparent, radically democratic crowdsourcing events, I guess crowdsourcing is the word, are helping Iceland build a better future. So if this process can help a nation build a constitution, what could it do for a bunch of techies at a tech conference? So this is what we're proposing. Something along these lines. So let's take our values. So we started this talk with a minute talking about our values. What if we take that all the way through this process that's been developed and refined and is open source and is transparent, and we can look at, what if we take this process from values all the way to ideas and all the way to vision? Where did this come from exactly? So last year at South By, I convened and moderated a panel that brought some of these people to talk about these projects, to talk about the various crowdsourcing things that were going on. And the response was really good. And we got a lot of great feedback. And we got a lot of interest. And later in the conference, Gudjon and I were sitting in one of the overflowing keynote sessions. And I forget who it was. But, you know, the presenter sits at the front, and you're like 10 miles away from them. And they're saying really interesting things. But you look around the audience, and, you know, everybody's talking, everybody's chatting, everybody's providing feedback in different ways. And I think this was kind of a light bulb moment for Gudjon. He said, let's think about doing the same thing here. So he refined a methodology. He posted this thing on Google Docs. He pitched it to UForest, and they thought it was a good idea. So the handbook for the facilitators for this potential event at South by next year is available online. I tried to come up with Google Docs URLs are pretty awful, but if you go to bit.ly/betterworld, you can see this actual document. It's open for editing. This goes through the actual methodology. It'll provide a lot more information about how these different rounds work and about how information is kind of forward-fed through the entire event. And also, we realize that this should be a grassroots South by effort. It shouldn't be something that we come up with and then is just done. And we realize that just like in Iceland, where we wanted this to have some authority and we wanted it to be really compelling, that we're interested in building this as a grassroots project here. And so the four or five of us who've been working on it, it's not enough, right? We need a lot more involvement. So a couple of things that I just want to bring up before I turn this over for some questions and things is that we're interested in sponsorship. If you represent a company that's working in crowdsourcing or working in these areas and you'd like to be associated with this event, there's lots of opportunities here for food and for maybe even employing new types of technology. So again, these Iceland events were simple by necessity because the budgets were very low and they didn't have a lot of time. But if we have a year to think about this and we have a year to think about interesting ways of maybe working with this data or interesting things that we can do at the individual tables, we should do so. We're interested in finding people who are interested in organizing this. So this is there's a lot here. It's a lot to get 1,000 people together. It's a lot to build the infrastructure that's needed to support that. So we're interested in that type of participation and even volunteers. The Icelandic events, they started with 9 volunteers, but the actual events ended up with 500 volunteers supporting this. Everything from the actual facilitators and runners between tables and data entry and health and wellness and all these things. So this is my pitch to you, I guess, at this point. And I'm almost done. And normally I'd say, what are your questions? But I'm going to turn this around and say, I have questions for you, actually. And so my questions are along these lines. So what better world issues could an assembly event like this best address? So the structure might lend itself better to certain types of questions than others. What types of questions could best be answered by a collaborative, democratic session? And what outcomes would you hope to see from a session like this? So my conclusion, or the too long didn't listen version, is we're planning an epic event for South by 2013, a little typo there, and we'd love for you to join us. Like I said, I'll be posting these slides. I've got several links for you to check out for more information, for more thoughts and things. But that's what I have. So I'd like to talk about this now. I'd like to you to answer my questions.
So you said 1,000 people.
It is.
And obviously, the range is just amazing. This draws a lot from the open space and you talk to the various organizations that are
no, so.
We have a National Coalition for Dialogue and Deliberation, the CDD, and they would perhaps could be very interested in thinking about this topic.
Oh, great.
There are other, probably the Internet Identity Workshop folks who have a conference twice a year. Julia Hamlin is a facilitator with the Internet Tradition Facility. So there are a lot of people who are in this tradition that, interested. I'm not sure
what connected to them. This process was mostly homegrown, right? So there's parallel tracks with a lot of these other types of projects, but there aren't the direct connections there right now, I don't think.
Well, I mean,
and there should be.
There are a lot of people who show up to South by Southwest who aren't in this one right now, but you have
great. That'd be fantastic. You don't even have to go to the microphones. We can all hear you.
I had a question about that pyramid around it.
Yes.
Somewhere in the middle there was something that said no speeches or seed planting.
Yes.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah. So this was the idea that one of the ways that something like this could go wrong, potentially, and one of the things that the planners were particularly concerned about is that someone else would set the agenda here. You know, they did have politicians there, they did have, you know, these change makers there, and so there was a concern that, or a risk that, you know, you get people thinking a particular way already. You know, you seed things. You know, you don't let the ideas and the themes grow organically out of the process. And so that was part of this. So it doesn't start out with, you know, a 1-hour lecture on the value of democracy, right? No, you get people talking about things right away. You know, so these events do have a master of ceremonies, but that master of ceremonies tells you when to break and tells you when to grab coffee and tells you when to get back to work. So that's the idea of no speeches.
One of the challenges we face here is the diversity of values and the diversity of worldviews. Like everybody comes here with a different expectation of what they're trying to get out of it, and that's one of the great things on the talk side. But without any sort of agenda, it would be the loudest person influencing the most in each, and I'm sure the facilitators would be trained, but I think like with Iceland, their goal was for a better Iceland. But here, our common value is we're all human. Like, that's pretty much where it ends. And so I don't know what issue, or it seems like there has to be some sort of topic in order for it to be.
So in the actual draft facilitator's handbook, there's some thoughts about that, and there's some thoughts about directions that we could point people. Because, yeah, it can't be a free-for-all, basically. Right, it has to be pointed in direction, but that's the idea, that it's not pointed in direction that precludes other discussion and other involvement.
Yeah. I think crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, that's a very powerful force that Southwest can help us direct, or at least show the opportunities. There's so many things we're already doing at Southwest Southwest, which is similar to the deal with participatory government, deal with healthcare issues, and so I think it's already a wonderful form for that, and it could be made even better.
Great. Yes?
I'm kind of familiar with this process here. I work at Whole Foods Market, and every 3 years we get together as a family, with tables. We get together with the global office, the regional office, the stores, distributing warehouse facilities, and we all meet together, and we talk about where we're at and where we're going. And a lot of what she was saying there, sometimes, the real passionate squeaky wheel kind of gets a lot of noise, but it's mostly white noise there. It's, because everybody there has a definite opinion. And it's very empowering. It's very empowering to see at the end, okay, this is what, we want to get to. And And those are the focus for the next 3 years. We focus on those codes, and we knock a lot of those codes out. We really do. So, yeah, it's a wonderful process.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because so out of this emerged a nonprofit, which was created to kind of centralize these ideas and centralize the planning for these things. And this nonprofit has actually advised a handful of corporate, you know, internal assemblies. So I know they did one for CCP, the Icelandic game manufacturing or game development studio. And it's, yeah, again, so the idea that this process gets good results from a variety of contexts, there's evidence for that at this point. Yes.
So the process that you described is very place based, in some sense,
you're getting together. Wondering if you see possibilities for non-place based, or assessing the right codes and assessing the right. Yeah, so obviously, one of the advantages of the technologies that we work with is they give us broader opportunities to do things in non-place-based settings. I think part of what was happening here, and part of something that doesn't happen online, is the event status. You know, the fact that you're in a room with 1,000 people is a qualitatively different experience than sitting alone at your laptop, you know, browsing ideas. So that was part of the thinking, was that it was important to have it. Place-based, to put people in this different type of creative environment where they see each other and they're being inspired by each other and they're really sharing with one another. That said, the First National Assembly also had a crowdsourcing website of sorts that they used. After the fact, there were lots of people that had this idea. There's like, this experience was so powerful, we want to continue it. How do we do that? So there was a website that was set up, you know, where you could basically input ideas and discuss them and refine them and talk about them in kind of the same way. So that did happen, and there's definitely value in that too. And again, this, regardless of how big this event would be, there would probably be additional people that would benefit from it and additional people that would, you know, like to participate in different ways. So that's also what I was kind of getting at, this idea of what are additional ways that that our technologies could be integrated into the process.
Yep. I see the slide that you have with all the links on it.
Yes.
Great. The other question is, this is my first year at South by Southwest, so a lot of what I see just looks normal to me. The people that I come out here with have been coming for years, and they're complaining about the number of people, the number of lines, and so forth. In my conversations, we've been talking about, like, the TED model, whether TEDx or the breakouts. Are those the type of things you're talking about? Or are we talking about looking at South by the interactive sessions as, you know, reaching a point where things need to change, and looking at the fact that you have so many people who are thinking outside the box? Are you kind of looking for solutions to those, or maybe thinking about how to organically grow? Where do we go from here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a project like this, you know, I pose this as an experiment. You know, we could see how it happens, because I still think there's a lot of value in, and there's a lot of people who are interested in, you know, being on the receiving end of great ideas. You know, it's something. It's also a powerful experience to be in a crowd of 1,000 people listening to somebody, you know, giving this really impassioned, inspiring speech at the front of the room. But yeah, it's also the case that you get. You get a lot of professionals together, you know, at a conference like this, and everyone has good ideas. Everyone has the potential to contribute. So this could complement, you know, the traditional model, and maybe it'll inspire other types of things. Maybe that's a question for us to talk about at the assembly next year. Anything else? Yes.
How many days? Is it one day? Is it the entire duration of South by? Did you ask people to ask people?
No, no, no. This would be an event. So probably a day or maybe a half a day. Where the logistics aren't in place yet. But the Icelandic events were one day events. So you had a series of sessions before lunch. You broke for lunch, and you had a series of sessions after lunch.
The reason I asked 2 years ago, I coordinated and hosted the first Oz initiative here, the official.
That'd be fantastic.
We rarely use. We broke it into 2 half-day sessions and focus on the issue of hunger, defined very specifically the questions that we wanted to answer.
Excellent.
And then have people come in and answer the
question. That'd be really useful. Thanks. We didn't do this. So the data was open. Anybody could take this data and do what they wanted. And so one company thought that they would apply some visualization to this data to look at this. So this wasn't part of the process, but
I'm just worried about a bit of a chaotic situation as opposed to
it should be controlled chaos is what we go for. And so yeah, this
I think that's really exciting. I do think one more thing is about how you get to the coming together, whether you start with
yep.
And then bring people together with that database knowledge going in, or if you start with the community and then grow the community from there. But where does the event take place in time? And the other thing is, then how do you follow up? Do you come back to 2014? So I think you should define now if it's a 2-year thing.
Yep. Yeah, good point.
Some of that is, you know, pre-organization and focus on topics. Some of that is not necessarily either having experience or not being comfortable or having knowledge of how effective the facilitation process is. Again, that's something, you know, what that specific process for all the facilitators are training on. Are they, you know, responsible?
Finishing up right on time, so thank you very much.